So good evening. This is, I've lost track, seventh class on this course. Last time we went up through, I think, verse 29, which completed the section that had to do with the refutation of some of the tenets of Chittamatra, since the Chittamatra view is, you know, pretty much refuted in terms of the final view of the Prasangika Madhyamaka, the consequence middle way school, which is Shantideva's main view that he's trying to get across in this chapter on the perfection of wisdom. Are there any questions on what we covered last time? I realize there was, I mean, these sections, and again, I'm finding this process of going through this commentary to be a difficult one, because there are places where this commentary isn't as clear as I'd like it to be, and when I try to go to my teacher's commentary on the commentary, often it's not so elaborate. So anyway, I'm hoping that we can at least get the gist of most of these verses and where we're going with this. So the good part of that refutation had to do with establishing that for Prasangika Madhyamaka, there isn't this illusion of things existing externally to the mind, which is what Chittamatra holds, that the external object and the subject knowing it are arising from the same sort of karmic seed potential on the consciousness that gives rise to this duality of subject and object. And this duality, seeing this object as external, is the ignorance that they feel is the root of all of our problems. However, in the Madhyamaka consequence school, this is not the illusion going on. There is an illusion going on, but the illusion has to do with the appearance and the adherence to inherent existence, to the intrinsic existence of the self, of all phenomena. So we're going to go into more detail on this in the verses to come, as well as when we get to the actual reasonings that prove the lack of inherent existence of the self and of phenomena. And other than dealing with this, you know, establishing that this is the view of Prasangika, there's also, because mind only doesn't refute inherent existence, particularly they are holding to the inherent existence of consciousness, of mind, of the subject that is knowing all this. So there is a part of this, you know, chapter that dealt with refuting that, with really trying to get Chittamatra to see how this was not logical for them to hold to the inherent existence of consciousness. We also spent some time with this idea of a self-cognizer. Again, there's, you know, a lot of little things we went through on that. I'm not going to go into a lot of that in detail because we spent a fair amount of time on that last time. But any questions then on kind of what we're doing and where we're moving from here? The next section actually kind of moves into having sort of said, well, first we sort of refuted some of the people who were holding this realist view, if you will, some adherence to true existence. Then we went to the mind-only school specifically because some of their tenets are directly contradicted. Now we're going to kind of look at, well, they might still have some question about the usefulness of this view of emptiness. So in this next section, we're primarily looking at, is this middle way path, this view of emptiness that we're propounding, necessary, and is it effective? You know, kind of, do we really need to realize this? And is it really going to, if we do realize this, is it going to do what Prasangika says it's going to do in effect? Because Prasangika, as you'll see when we go through this section and the section to follow, is unique among all the schools of that we went through in this system of tenets. You know, we went through all the individual tenet systems, in that what they hold as the fundamental ignorance that is keeping us all bound in cyclic existence is the same as the fundamental ignorance that we need to overcome and the wisdom that we need to generate to do that, as, you know, to become a Buddha. So in all the other schools, we saw that there were two sort of separate paths. There are two separate paths in middle way, but there's two separate realizations in order to achieve just liberation, mere liberation from samsara. Not to go on to complete enlightenment. It was necessary in general to realize what? That was in all of the schools up to Prasangika Madhyamaka. What was the realization that was needed? The selflessness of person specifically, the lack of a substantially existent, self-sufficient person, which in the Prasangika school is said to be actually a coarse view of selflessness. So this isn't the one that gets you out of cyclic existence, according to Prasangika. All the other schools said, if you want to become, you know, a foe destroyer, someone who's actually completely annihilated all the afflictive obstructions, the afflictions and their roots, all you need to realize is this lack of a self-sufficient person. Prasangika says that's coarse. Instead, you need to realize the lack of true existence. You might use the basis of a person, but there's no difference between the basis of a person and the basis of phenomena in terms of what you're realizing about those bases. They're different bases, but selflessness of person, selflessness of phenomena, same selflessness, lack of inherent existence. So again, the other schools are going to be taking some offense at this, primarily because they look at it and they go, well, Prasangika, you're saying that everybody needs to realize this. Isn't it enough to realize the lack of a self-sufficient self? Isn't it enough to, you know, have some other form of selflessness that will act as the means to get out of cyclic existence? And all that this is needed for, perhaps, is to become a Buddha, if it's needed at all. So there's lots of these little points that we're going to be looking at when we get into this. This first part is going to primarily look at kind of, again, this ineffectiveness. Is it really necessary to realize this lack of inherent existence, and what could it possibly do? Because the other thing we have to recall then is that all the schools below Prasangika adhere to inherent existence. They say that a consciousness knowing the inherent existence of this cup is a valid consciousness. So what we're doing in Prasangika by refuting that, it goes against the grain of all the other schools, because they all think that it's completely valid to say that this cup exists from its own side by way of its own characteristics, independently, intrinsically, substantially, you know, inherently, all these terms that we use to get at this mode of existence that for all the other schools is simply how things are. This is how they exist naturally. Well, but they're not going to just go after plastics and things either, though. I mean, in terms of I mean, this is a view that pervades all phenomena. But
no, I'm not talking about specific substance, but at least these substances so insubstantial. Now,
yeah.
I don't know. It just keeps.
I don't know if we do, though. Really.
Really? Well, we don't emotionally necessarily. But
yeah.
I mean, if you look at something philosophically.
Yeah. Anyway, we can discuss this as we go through some of these. But so let's go ahead. What I want to do first, as I've been doing, for Brenda's sake in particular, because she's kind of just getting familiar with this text and that, on page 231 is where we're at. And unfortunately, the way they've structured this is they've given us all the verses that are in that section and then all the commentary. So what I'm having to do is to, before we go into each section, I'm giving you the breakdown of where that verse is commented on. So if we turn to page 232, where the commentary starts on this section, that paragraph that at the top, if you want to pencil these in, where it says mind only, proponents, and so forth, that paragraph is verse 30. When it gets to there's a little break, and then it says middle way, proponents, that magician, that paragraph that ends there where it says afflictions are produced, that's verse 31. I'm sorry, it actually keeps going on. There's quite a bit of commentary on 31. So 31 goes all the way down to the next page. Page 233 at the top where it says if one cultivates, if I lose anybody in this, let me know. If one cultivates the latencies of emptiness right there, that's verse 32. The next paragraph, when it is said, no thing exists truly, that's verse 33. The next paragraph, since there is no property, that's verse 34. All the way down to where it says objection, the first objection, if the Buddhas have pacified all conceptions, that's verse 35. That includes the response. The objection at the bottom of the page, going on to the response at the top of the next page, is two verses, 36 and 37. They don't really neatly break up within that, but that and the objection and the response cover those two verses, 36 and 37. page 234, where it says, here's school, that is verse 38, and that goes through that text in italics. And then the next paragraph that says, either conventionally or in thusness, that's verse 39. A little bit neater this time, not all those A, B, C's, and D's and stuff. So what we'll do to start things off then is go ahead and read together verse 30. So we're back on page 231. Even if one knows them to be like illusions, how will the afflictions be averted? Even the very creator of an illusion woman will produce attachment. So now if we go to the commentary on 232, this is pretty straightforward. It says mind-only proponents and so forth, because this is basically all of the other Buddhist schools that are kind of now looking at, as I said, we presented this view of emptiness and that we feel this is the final view that needs to be realized. Because it completely cuts against the grain of what they adhere to, which is inherent existence of all phenomena, they're trying to find fault with it. And so they're basically saying, you know, even if you've determined this, that all phenomena lack inherent existence, you know, even if this is the truth, and you know that, in the absence of a purpose, you know, such as the abandonment of afflictive obstructions by it, again, the afflictive obstructions are what keep you bound in cyclic existence. The knowledge obstructions are what keep you from being a Buddha. So at the point where we're just simply talking about removing the afflictive obstructions, if you determine this, it says they're having determined such, is nothing but fatigue. So their point is kind of like, okay, spend what time you want trying to realize this lack of inherent existence, but it doesn't serve any purpose. It's not going to cut the root of cyclic existence. It's not going to do anything to get you out of this. In effect, they're saying it's an ineffective realization, that there's really nothing to it because they don't hold it to be a fundamental ignorance that's at the root of all of our problems. They use, they go on to say, even if you were to assert that there is a purpose, how will the afflictions be averted by it? And they're going to posit an example, going back to this idea of a magician. You know, we've used this example before, Svatantrika Madhyamika likes this example, this analogy of a magician that conjures up an illusory woman or an illusory elephant or whatever, and the audience, you know, believes in it. The magician, because they're putting the spell on the rock or the pebble and making it into this illusory being, they know that it's an illusion. So they're kind of challenging this using this example, and they say it follows that they will not be averted by it because even the very magician, the creator of an illusion woman, although realizing the emptiness of an external woman, thinking, what if this illusion woman could be enjoyed? It is seen that the magician will produce attachment. So the idea here is that even though this magician has some idea that this is an illusory woman, it still could be a source of attachment for the magician. Well, I think it's also, even though that what they're talking about is somebody who really hasn't developed a deeper conviction of the illusory nature of it. And that's what the answer that Shantideva is going to take it in that direction. Saying basically that at the point, even like, you know, all of us in the room here who have some view of emptiness based on some study of this, have we really gotten to the point where it undermines the attachment that we have to things, which is said to be rooted in our view of them as inherently existent? As, you know, we can see them as illusory to a degree, but is it enough to undermine our attachment? Is it enough to keep us from getting entangled with all these objects? So this person goes on, these proponents go on to say, besides the mere realization of emptiness by you through initial hearing and contemplation, you know, there's nothing. Basically, they're saying, you know, this is ineffectual. It really is not getting to the root of any of our problems. Having that understanding that things are illusory, that they don't exist the way they appear, doesn't help. It doesn't really cut through and, you know, help us to abandon our attachment. Any questions on that? Kind of this view that's being set out? Let's go ahead and read the middle way response, verse 31. That creator has not abandoned the latencies of the afflictions with respect to objects of knowledge. Therefore, when he sees it, his latencies of emptiness are weak. So let's go to the commentary, and basically this is, it's a little bit confusing in this section, partly because there's this analogy of the magician knowing the illusory woman and having attachment to the illusory woman, but then there's also, that is the understanding of someone who is realizing emptiness. I'll try to help you sort of pick through this when we go through the rest of this commentary, because again, 31, the rest of this page under the top of the next page is all under this verse of 31. So the magician, the creator of the illusion, according to what Middle Way is saying, has not abandoned even slightly the latencies of the afflictions. The apprehension of true existence with respect to the object of knowledge, that is, to the illusion woman, and apprehends this, you know, as truly existent. So this idea of true existence, there's going to be other parts in this commentary where they really are differentiating this idea of a magician seeing an illusory woman, which is just an analogy, from someone who's realizing emptiness, knowing the illusory nature of phenomena. They're very different wisdoms. You know, we can't say that just because somebody is a magician and they conjure up an illusory woman and they know that that illusory woman isn't real, that they realize emptiness. But it's interesting in this commentary, they almost seem to be equating the two. When we talk about true existence, I mean, true existence could be applied in many different ways. As we saw in our study of tenets, the term true existence means something very different for Svatantrika Madhyamika than it does for Prasangika Madhyamika. And we even saw some passages in the previous section when we were refuting mind only, where we were saying, if it exists as it appears, then it must be truly existent. The truth of existence is, when we say truly existent, oftentimes simply means things existing the way that they appear. So we could look at this analogy of this magician creating an illusory woman and say that that lacks some true existence. Why? Because it appears to be a real woman, but it isn't a real woman. It's an illusory woman. So at some level, we could say that that's a lack of true existence. It's obviously not the Prasangika point of view of a lack of true existence, because it's very specific to this illusion that's going on with mantra and, you know, a salve that's applied to their eyes and all this stuff that causes this illusory woman to appear. Are you following what I'm saying? So in this commentary, again, there will be times when it seems like he's using this term as if this magician is really realizing true existence, but there's quite a distinction between the lack of true existence that the magician is realizing by saying that this illusory woman doesn't exist as a real woman, versus the lack of true existence that a Prasangika Madhyamika person realizes, knowing that that woman doesn't, or that any phenomenon doesn't exist inherently. Okay? Hope I made that clear. So this last part of this paragraph, therefore, when he sees it, when he is like engaged in this object, because he hasn't even begun to get rid of, you know, the deeper ignorance that's involved, the afflictions and so on that are, you know, based on ignorance, not knowing the way things actually exist. Therefore, when he sees it, his latencies of realization of emptiness are weak, whereby afflictions are produced. So again, in the same way that we could say for this magician, who, although this magician knows that this isn't a real woman, he's still going to have attachment for this illusory woman. Why? Because his view of that emptiness of this real woman isn't strong enough to overcome the affliction of attachment. In the same way, when we talk about our generation of a realization of the lack of true existence of any phenomenon, it isn't so strong, you know, that we can actually undermine our attachment. And that's what I was saying earlier. All of you, you know, have some idea of what emptiness means. Has it become strong enough that you actually have undermined your attachment to these objects? Most likely not. I mean, maybe it has, and if it has, that's terrific. But, you know, for most of us, it takes a deeper level of understanding than just the wisdom that arises from our own hearing, from our own thinking about emptiness, and so on. Ideally, this is the antidote to all of our problems. And it said, you know, that when we develop it at a very deep level through meditation, that it can serve as that antidote and undermine all of the ignorance and afflictions that are the source of all of our problems. However, with this way that we know it right now, we don't have the latencies or the imprints of knowing emptiness that are strong enough to help us overcome these afflictions. Now, what's going to happen in the rest of this page is that there's going to be lots of other sort of clarifications about what this response is and the way that this response could have been. They could have responded in a different way and whether that would be correct or not, and the types of mistakes that we make. And just have some patience as we go through this. I think it's quite an interesting section because it really does get at some way of understanding kind of what's going on, analyzing it a little bit more so that we're clear about the errors that we're making and why this is our fundamental error. This next paragraph, it says, first, there's an alternative reply that somebody could give, that Shantideva, well, this is actually Drakpa Gyaltsen. Drakpa Gyaltsen is saying that it's incorrect if we were to use this reply. So let's read this reply. The realization by the previous ones that the illusion woman is empty of being a woman does not abandon afflictions, since that emptiness is merely a trifling emptiness. Rather, they are abandoned by the realization of emptiness which pervades our middle way system. Okay, so let's analyze this response. So somebody could say, this realization that, and again, I'm differentiating these two realizations, the magician looking at the illusory woman and saying this isn't a real woman, versus the Madhyamika meditator, the yogi, realizing the lack of inherent existence of whatever object. We could choose a woman, we could choose, a rock, whatever you want to look at. That realization of the lack of inherent existence or true existence of that versus this magician's realization. So this very first part of it is saying basically it's incorrect to say that this magician's realization is what he calls it here, and this translation is kind of strange, a trifling emptiness. Other texts might call it like a minor emptiness. The idea being that it's a weaker realization of emptiness. So this argument is pertaining to the fact that they see this magician realizing this lack of there being a real illusory, a real woman where there is this illusory woman appearing, is kind of a minor realization of emptiness that simply isn't strong enough to cut through the ignorance. Whereas the view that Madhyamika is positing is strong enough to cut through that. So this might sound like an okay response in some regard, because we could say certainly that these are both some form of an emptiness of a true existence. Again, this true existence term being applied very loosely in this regard, in that this illusory woman doesn't exist as a real woman, doesn't exist in the way that it appears to be. The response, though, as far as the reason why this is incorrect is given here in the commentary. So right there, right after the quotes where it says why this is refuted, why this is incorrect, is because the magician's realization that the illusion woman is empty of being a woman is not a trifling realization of emptiness. Being specific here, a trifling realization of emptiness that relies on the subtle object of refutation. So what this idea, and again, the way I'm reading this, is that this person's reply is them seeing this as kind of like a weaker version of the realization of emptiness that could only really cut through our attachment and so on if it were stronger, if it were kind of advanced in potential based on the understanding of the middle way and so on. The point is that this isn't even a trifling version of emptiness. Because it in order for it to be emptiness, in order for Prasangika Madhyamika to agree to it as being emptiness, it has to refute this subtle object of negation, subtle object of refutation, which is what? True existence, inherent existence, as it's defined by Prasangika Madhyamika. So they're just not wanting this to be, I think the point of this is they're not wanting you to confuse these two as from what I'm saying, we're prone to do. This analogy that Shantideva is using of the magician and the illusory woman, confusing that in any way that is really a realization of emptiness. It's not. It has nothing to do with this subtle object of refutation that the Prasangika Madhyamika is adhering to, that says this is the problem we have. our conception that things exist inherently, truly, from their own side, by way of their own characteristics, through their own power, this view of phenomena existing in that way is what a view of emptiness is refuting. If it's not refuting that or touching that subtle object of negation in any way, it's not emptiness. So they're just not wanting, you know, any there to be any confusion about what this magician's realization is versus a true practitioner of the consequence middle way school. Because as it says in brackets there, since that realization must realize the illusion woman as lacking true existence here again defined by Prasangika Madhyamika. So if we were talking about the illusion woman, we're talking about, because an illusion woman is empty of inherent existence too. Correct? All phenomena are empty of inherent existence. So if the magician had studied Madhyamika consequence school and was realizing the lack of inherent existence of the illusory woman, that would be one thing. But he's only realizing this, the fact that this illusory woman isn't a real woman. And he's not even realizing it very deeply because he's still having attachment to this illusory woman in spite of realizing that it's just an illusion. Okay? So as I said, in this section, these two different views get a little mixed up, and I think this paragraph is really trying to define them quite clearly and say, this view of the magician, what he's realizing about this illusory woman, if there was a Prasangika Madhyamika practitioner in the room, they would be looking at that illusory woman if they had this real understanding of emptiness and negating something very different than the magician's negating. The magician's negating a very, very, very coarse way that this doesn't exist as a real woman. So, from explanations elsewhere, continuing with this paragraph, the end of this paragraph, from explanations elsewhere, you should understand, one, the identification of the object of refutation, and two, that if one realizes the absence upon one phenomenon, then understanding comes with respect to other phenomena and so forth. So let's explain these two, go into these in a little bit more detail. Point one, this is one of the main points of the Gelugpa school of Tibetan Buddhism, which is based in Madhyamika Prasangika, you know, this middle way consequence view. Lama Tsongkhapa spends volumes, and in a lot of his texts, I mean, if you go to the Lamrim Chenmo, the great treatise on the stages of the path, there's extensive, you know, commentary on identifying the object of negation correctly. I'm not going to go into that in here. The next text that we're going to pursue in the beginning of the year is Lama Tsongkhapa's middling stages of the path, and we'll go into there in as pretty sufficient detail the identification of the object of refutation or the object of negation. According to this Gelugpa view, this is really where it starts in terms of our understanding of emptiness. We first have to identify the mistaken way that we see things. We have to clearly know what the thief looks like before we try to identify in the crowd of people who the thief is so that we can apprehend that thief. So in the same way, we have to have a very clear view of what it is we're trying to refute. What is it we're trying to negate? Yeah, Barbara. We'll be discussing that in next year. Well, we're going to start that text in the beginning of next year. I don't think we'll get... It's towards the end. It's a rather long text. On Wednesday nights, this class will finish, the Shantideva text.
Oh, so it's going to be Wednesday nights.
Yeah. This is another text in the basic program, the middling stages of the path. And, yeah, we've decided... I hope that's okay with everyone. We didn't kind of consult with a lot of people, but my feeling is that we should kind of go into a Lamrim text after this, to really develop a good foundation in Lamrim, because most of the other texts that we're going to study are offshoots of that. Actually, the Stages of the Path text is what they often recommend that you start your basic program with. And we started with Shantideva, which is fine. You know, that's another text that they say is okay to start with. But obviously, we're already kind of like this deep. And so, you know, with the Lamrim, we'll be this deep. Okay. Or maybe we could, you know, keep going, keep sinking. With the Lamrim, we'll be able to get a pretty good foundation because it's an elaboration of all the things that we've already, many of you have already studied in discovering Buddhism, kind of going deeper into a lot of that. Anyway, this point is that in the Gelugpa point of view, we really do feel like this is the starting point for our realization of emptiness, is clearly discerning what is it we're refuting. And that's why even the tenets course was very much, when we talked about the selflessness in each of these schools, very much geared at what is it that they're saying doesn't exist. That's really what we're talking about here, this object of negation or refutation. What are we refuting? What are we negating? And here it's intrinsic existence, inherent existence. They're equating that to true existence, existing by way of its own character, independent of... Another way to look at the sort of measure of true existence is anything more than existing nominally, merely labeled. You know, because this is, in the end, how things exist conventionally, through mere imputation to our conceptual mind, putting a label of some sort, whether it be a word or an image or what have you, on that's it. That's the way things exist. There's no mode of existence beyond that. Anything more than that is to be negated. So that's the first point. And that, you know, what Drogba Gyaltsen is doing here is that he's saying that in this whole section, with regard to this verse, there's two things that he really thinks you need to sort of walk away with. One is making sure we sort of understand and appreciate the need to identify this object of negation. Second point is that we can tell whether we actually have the right object of negation if, in our realization of emptiness, if we do get to that place where we're conceptually even realizing, like, you know, the emptiness of this microphone, by turning my mind to, you know, pencil, the realization should be the same. Again, the basis is different. And even if I turn it to the self, to the person, different basis, but the realization should be the same. There should be a lack of inherent existence, a lack of inherent existence, a lack of inherent existence, wherever I look, a lack of inherent existence. As he says here, that if one realizes the absence upon one phenomenon, then understanding comes with respect to other phenomena and so forth. So there's a quote that's often given, and I think my teacher mentioned it. I'm not sure. Maybe it was in another one of the commentaries. I think it's actually in the commentaries that His Holiness used when he was teaching this in France. Aryadeva's 400 stanzas. It's in the 8th chapter, verse 16, which in here, because they go out to 400, so they go sequentially through them. It's the 191st verse. Aryadeva says, "Whoever sees one thing is said to see all. That which is the emptiness of one is the emptiness of all." So it's the same idea. You know, if you see the emptiness of microphone, all you have to do is turn to another object and you see the emptiness of that object. If you've gotten the correct identification of the object of refutation and realized it correctly, it doesn't matter what basis you use, you're realizing the same thing. So oftentimes, it's said that we do actually start with the realization of the self of persons, selflessness of persons first, by refuting how we see the self. Now, as you know, in our study, even what we said earlier tonight, there is this coarser view of a self of persons that Prasangika says isn't our problem. You know, it's part of our problem, but it's not the root problem. You know, it's a coarser version of ignorance that we have that we want to refute as well, but we have to refute this subtler view of the self. So, for example, it is said that it's best to start with realizing emptiness of the person, because this is something that we're really familiar with the object. You know, we know the I, the person, the self, from our being with it constantly and being with the ignorance that misapprehends it quite a bit of the time. So if we're realizing the lack of self-sufficiency on the basis of the self, and we turn to an external object or turn to the aggregates, you know, the hand or the body or whatever, do we have the same understanding of its emptiness, its selflessness? If we're only realizing lack of self-sufficiency, we won't have that. If we're realizing the lack of inherent existence of the self, it will naturally translate to whatever object we turn to. Yeah, Barbara.
I was going to say that I hardest one to give up.
Well, it is, and yet it really is the one that's most involved in our suffering, of course, and that's part of it, and that's why it is sort of hard to give up. But it actually is said to be easier to, I don't want to say easier to realize, easier to work with. I don't think
so
that...
So I have that backwards then. It's easier to work with?
Easier to work with. Emptiness is hard to realize on whatever basis. I don't want to give the impression that it's easier on one basis or another. It's said that it is best to start with the person because of our familiarity with the person, the basis of that emptiness. You know, we spend all our time with the person. We spend a lot of our time, like I said, with the misconception of the person. You know, so the idea that we could have a realization on that basis is, you know, I don't want to use the word easier again, more quickly perhaps. I mean, that we'll be able to discern it because of our familiarity with the object, with the basis. Yes, it's hard to give up. I mean, but it's hard to give up our adherence in any regard. Because the adherence, this mind that is adhering to it, is the same. The misconception is the same. It's the objects that are different that we're adhering to. Okay. So we'll be actually, the very last section of for this course, part four, is dealing with this realization of the selflessness of persons. Oftentimes it's taught first because, again, it's where you supposedly start with your meditation on emptiness. But you should be able to, as I said, turn from when you feel like, okay, the eye doesn't exist in that way, then you can turn to, you know, the arm or some part of the body, some part of the mind, or some other external phenomena, and you should be able to have the same realization about it if you've gotten the correct view of emptiness. Okay. Next paragraph. Any questions? Okay, next paragraph. Hence, in general, and this is now a paragraph where we're going to talk a bit about mistakes, errors, you know, how we get in trouble. In general, with respect to mistakes, as in the case of seeing of falling hairs due to cataracts, we talked about this before. And I don't know technically if this really happens with cataracts. It might be some other eye disease or whatever, but the idea is that if you have something that is causing the appearance of what look like falling hairs constantly, you know, in your eye, it's due to some sort of a defect in the eye. So this mistake, you know, because it's non-conceptual, this mistake will not be averted through the mental consciousness, understanding that there are no falling hairs. In order to avert this mistaken appearance, you have to try to eliminate the cause of it, the cataracts or whatever eye disease is there. So this is one type of mistake that's basically non-conceptual. It's not involving our conceptual mind, and our conceptual mind can't help us through it. Why? Because there's another problem going on that is not related to our conception. It's a defect in the eye that's causing the appearance of these. No matter how much we understand, you know, that these hairs don't exist, it doesn't really help us in terms of them disappearing or that ignorance or mistake being removed. However, with regard to conceptual mistakes, there's going to be two types that we're going to talk about here. There's one, mistakes that arise from temporary incidental causes, which can be averted by merely realizing something contrary to that. For example, Prasangika often uses this as an example, but again, I don't want to, this isn't, in this case, it's really referring to something different. Say you're out, you know, in the yard at night, and, you know, it's very, or at dusk, dark, and you see something in the corner of your yard that appears to be a snake. It's got, you know, like a coiled, striped thing, and you forget that you left, you know, coiled, striped rope over in that corner or something, or maybe, you know, a kid was playing and left it in the corner of your yard or something. So your immediate response is to see that as a snake. As soon as you get out your flashlight, though, or even you stay in the presence of it and you realize it's not moving or it's not doing anything, or you kick it a little and it's, you know, obvious that it's a rope, then you're immediately over that conception. Okay? So you don't keep going around thinking there's a snake in your yard after you've, like, shone a flashlight on it and seen that it's just a striped robe. You know, you've gotten over it. Your conception, your misconception's gone. However, there's another one that's much more pervasive, and that is the category of this apprehension of true existence that we have. It says, the apprehension of true existence in the continua of all migrating beings has been greatly habituated with in their continua since time without a beginning, which cannot be perceived even by the Buddhas. So what we're talking about here in regard to conceptual mistakes is something that's been going on a lot longer, that we're quite habituated towards. So it's not this mistaken conceptual mind just on the basis of not seeing something correctly or not apprehending it correctly in the moment. It's based on having apprehended it incorrectly throughout beginningless time, something we've done again and again and again and again. It is... Well, that's the referring to time without a beginning. Well, what this is saying is they're not saying, the Buddhas don't see a beginning. So there's time without a beginning which cannot be perceived by the Buddhas. Does everybody follow that? So there's no beginning. And actually when the Buddha was asked, is there a beginning, is there an end, the Buddha remained silent because there was nothing to say, you know, or anything he did say might cause more misconceptions to arise, but... So, this is an interesting phrase coming up here, this next sentence. It says, it is as though it has thoroughly cooked the continuum. So all your minds are cooked, okay? They're baked. They're kind of burnt. I mean, they've been in the microwave way too long. So, therefore, as it says here, let alone its seeds. I mean, let alone the seeds of these conceptions. Let's not even talk about them. Let's just talk about the conception itself. How can even the manifest coarse apprehension of true existence be averted by the mere realization of lack of true existence? So, you know, we can't really, you know, cut through it just by some superficial realization of lack of inherent existence, because we've been familiar with this misconception for so long. This is why, as I said earlier, you know, we all have some understanding of emptiness, but has it really affected our realization of, you know, the way things exist and undermined our attachment and so on? No. Why? Because we're just too familiar with our misconception. Not that it can't ever be overcome, but that understand the strength of it, you know, recognize the enemy. So it says, not only just that, even though, here we're talking about the initial direct realization, you could put initial in brackets there between the and direct, even though the initial direct realization of the lack of true existence abandons the acquired afflictions along with their seeds, it does not abandon the innate afflictions. So again, what point in the path is this when we have that? Talk about the five paths, path of accumulation, preparation, seeing, meditation, no more learning. Where does the initial direct realization of emptiness happen? Path of seeing, our initial seeing of reality, completely removes the acquired afflictions and their seeds. Again, those of you who weren't in the tenets class, I think I passed this out previously, but I have more copies of it if someone needs it. If you don't have this, I don't know, did you have this, John? Does anyone else need a copy? So on this chart, this details out the progression of the Bodhisattva through these five paths. So at this point right here, where it's point seven, this is the entrance into the path of seeing. The Bodhisattva meditates on emptiness, goes into meditative equipoise. Their realization of emptiness ceases to be conceptual. It's like water poured into water, the mind realizing emptiness. It becomes the antidote to the acquired afflictions. So at this point, the afflictive obscurations, the acquired version of that, which means things we've gotten through wrong tenets and through wrong thinking in this lifetime, all of that gets removed. the innate ones aren't even removed yet. You have to get your second realization of emptiness at the end of the path of seeing, well, where it ends and you begin the path of meditation in order to begin to whittle away at the innate afflictions.
Sorry,
yes?
Do you begin to whittle away at the innate afflictions with the path of seeing? Or?
It's actually that second realization is the beginning of the path of meditation, and that's where you realize, where you begin to abandon the innate. So the innate get abandoned in levels all the way through the seventh ground. At the end of the seventh ground, you have another meditative equipoise that acts as the antidote to the last of the innate. Then you go into working with the knowledge obstructions. So this was just in terms of the afflictive obstructions. So the bodhisattva has to go through those first and then begin to work on the knowledge obstructions.
So with the path of seeing, is this just one initial
meditation session?
One initial meditation session, and then you realize
You've realized you've got the wisdom realizing emptiness. You just, it isn't powerful enough, if you will. It does increase in its power the more that you meditate on it.
Nor is it sustained.
I mean, it's sustained as long as is necessary. There's different views about how long this path of seeing lasts, this meditative equipoise on the path of seeing. Yeah, the second moment of it, according to Prasangika, is a subsequent cognizer. The first one is a yogic direct perceiver.
That's a joke.
How many yogic direct perceivers are... Yeah. No, it lasts longer than a second, for sure. Because you have to have some duration to it to act as the antidote to all the various, you know... Yeah. And then when you come out of that, there's two parts of the meditative equipoise. Again, there's that initial realization that acts as the antidote, and then there's the liberated path when you've actually gotten rid of it. It no longer, the acquired afflictions are no longer there. There's a true cessation at that point. And then you have subsequent attainment after you come out of that meditative session. Then you go accumulating some more merit, because it's not just dependent upon wisdom. You also have to have the sufficient amount of merit. In other words, the bodhisattva could go on to meditate on emptiness and have direct realizations of emptiness in here, but they're not powerful enough to get you to that next level because you haven't accumulated enough merit either. I'm sorry?
The merit?
The merit? Any of the positive potential that's created through practicing the six perfections and so on, you know, through practicing generosity and patience and, you know, all the other deeds of a bodhisattva. I mean, yeah, all these sorts of things that offering practices, yeah, all of that, you know. So the bodhisattva doesn't, like, just start, get to this point with merit and then keeps realizing emptiness and doesn't have to accumulate any merit. As it said on the top there, there's a first countless great eon of merit, then a second great countless eon of merit, then a third great countless eon of merit. According to the sutra presentation, you need to have that much merit to make it through those three pieces of the path, if you will. The two paths that are prior to your direct realization, the path that gets you all the way, a path of seeing and meditation up to the point where you've gotten rid of the afflictive obstructions, and then you need another great countless eon of merit to get through the knowledge obstructions. So with those two together, the bodhisattva has both tools necessary to go through that. So anyway, the point here was that even this initial direct realization of emptiness doesn't cut through all of your innate, you know, afflictive obstructions. So why would you think that just understanding emptiness kind of casually or in a more informal way and not even a direct realization is going to do anything that profound? It will have some bearing the stronger it gets, but obviously even for the bodhisattva, needs to continue to work on undermining and abandoning these levels of afflictions before they are really gone. You know, they may not be manifest so much after you end up on this part of the path, but it's not like you've gotten rid of them. You know, you still have that seed for attachment and anger and so on. You know, you've got some pretty major wisdom that keeps you from kind of going there, but, you know, they're still there. You have to undermine them. Okay. So, I already read that one. For this reason, the presentation of paths, such as the path of meditation, which is to be familiarized for a long time, has been frequently taught. It has been asserted that the realization of emptiness will extinguish afflictions eventually, and that is sufficient. It has not been and is not being asserted that it is necessary for the realization of emptiness to abandon them immediately. The condensed reply is, how can that be necessary? I mean, how can it be necessary that you're able to, just in the magician realizing that this isn't a real woman, that he's going to immediately abandon all of his afflictions towards it? Just that superficial conceptual knowledge isn't enough, because that's the type of conception that is familiarized with over great time that we need to undermine through much more powerful antidotes. If it was just a, you know, smaller conception, you know, this first type of conception of mistaking a striped rope for a snake, we could get rid of it quite easily. But that's not the type of misconception we're talking about. Cool stuff, huh? Okay, let's take a break. So let's take maybe about a 10-minute break, and we can come back and continue. So, any questions then so far about what we've talked about? So this last paragraph that is in this section on verse 31 is again one of these where it's, in my mind, confusing these two things that it sounded like earlier they were wanting to make very clear, that the magician realizing the illusory woman's not a real woman is very different from a yogi realizing the lack of inherent existence of the illusory woman or anything else. But let's go through it and we'll kind of, you know, comment where we need to. That magician who created the illusion woman has not abandoned the latencies of the afflictions, the apprehension of true existence to the object of knowledge that is the observed object, the illusion woman, and apprehends it as truly existent. Therefore, when he sees that the illusion woman is empty of being a woman, those latencies of emptiness are weak and lack the ability to harm the apprehension of true existence, because they do not contradict its mode of apprehension. So kind of the idea here, again, is something we've seen before. I think he's trying to simply reiterate what we've talked about. But if we saw things solely from the point of view of the lack of true existence that Prasangika Madhyamika is holding to, so let's not deal with this other thing of whether it's a real woman or an illusory woman, but, and then let's, you know, leave that out of it. If someone hasn't familiarized themselves enough with this view of emptiness, if they haven't really deeply ingrained it into their consciousness, it's unlikely that they're going to be able to undermine their attachment, that their view of it as illusory in that regard, of whatever phenomenon they're observing, even with some understanding of emptiness, isn't going to serve to uproot their afflictions. Because, you know, we can all walk around with that at this point in our understanding of emptiness. You know, things are illusory. They don't exist in the way that they appear. Does it cause you to relate to them any differently? Generally, no. You know?
Why is my printer coming out with blue ink? Never mind. It does it when I'm angry. That really shouldn't have anything to do with it.
And the reason why is that very last line on page 232, because they do not contradict its mode of apprehension. The mode of apprehension is the mistaken belief that they exist inherently. We're not dealing with it at a point where it directly contradicts that, so that all of this gets undermined. You know, it's just not strong enough yet. It's just not familiar enough, because we're so familiar with the opposite.
It's kind of like trying to go back now. You see that it's empty in a certain structural ways, and then somehow it's plucked back into engaged in.
I mean, and we have to realize that, again, a piece of it is the appearance of inherent existence, which is caused, these are the knowledge obstructions, the imprints that we have on the consciousness from the conception of true existence that causes things to appear in that way.
I just had a mind of
a mind-only thought.
Yeah, in the sense that the afflictions are rising and the appearance is arising at the same time. You know, so if you persist in seeing the emptiness, then you do.
But are they really arising at exactly the same time? According to Prasangika, you have to have the object first before you can have a mind apprehending that object in whatever way it's apprehending it.
But
yeah. I mean, Prasangika has a big problem when we say these things arise at the same time. We can have the object existing as the same time as our mind, but the object existing as the object of that affliction has to exist a second before, like a millisecond or whatever, just immediately before that, or else we can't have a mind apprehending it. It doesn't apprehend. We never apprehend anything really in the present, per se. We're always, our objects are always slightly before.
How does premonition figure
out? I don't know, April. Premonition, that is a valid cognition of things
that's
that are going to
actually experience.
Yeah.
But you have probably experienced it before. In the sense that you've experienced like things before.
It's a really hard one. We had some real interesting discussions in the master's program about dream objects. How does a dream object exist before our apprehension of a dream object? Since they're all in our mind anyway. But anyway, these.
Because they're all constructions.
That what?
What did you say?
We couldn't come to an answer. We just had to kind of accept that the Prasangika point of view of things having to exist. Because this is, you know, kind of how they define the objective condition for a consciousness that knows an object, is that the observed object exists the moment before it is apprehended.
That would still work for a premonition.
Yeah.
Whatever was existed already, you just got a sense of it.
Yeah.
That and experience that.
Well, then when you start dealing with, you know, a Buddha's, well, Buddha's mind is different anyway to begin with. But even if we say, if there is a clairvoyance that knows past and future lives, how does it know future lives if they, do those exist in the moment before it knows them?
I think when you're a Buddha, it's that you're...
But I think there are clairvoyances that know past and future lives before Buddhahood.
But it's patterns.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Let's let this go because otherwise we're going to be I don't know that I want to go there simply because it starts getting into time and space and these are concepts that maybe we're going to blow out of the water at some point anyways. The last little bit on the top of page 233 says latencies in the text where it says latencies of the affliction. So if we go back to, I don't know again if this was in the root text or, yeah, it's in the verse 31, that very first line, that creator has not abandoned the latencies of the afflictions. It says here latencies in that phrase can refer to the apprehension of true existence, the conception of true existence, and can refer to its seeds and the knowledge obscurations. However, here it is taken to be the former. So it's just saying in this context, when we use this phrase, when Shantideva uses this phrase, latencies of the afflictions, we're simply talking about that apprehension of true existence, the active manifest conception of things as true existence, not the seeds for that, nor the imprints from that that cause the dualistic appearance, the mistaken appearance of things as inherently existent. Again, those are the knowledge obstructions. But really we're just talking about the apprehension of true existence, period. Okay, I think we're on to the next verse. Let's read verse 32 together. Through cultivating the latencies of emptiness, the latencies of things will be abandoned, and through familiarizing with nothing whatsoever exists, later on, that too will be abandoned. Sounds pretty mysterious, huh? Going to the commentary, top of page 233, if one cultivates these sort of latencies, or, you know, this word latency is being used rather liberally here, we usually don't refer to the latencies of emptiness. What it means, though, is it means really developing the familiarity with emptiness, if you will. I mean, we plant latencies or imprints for whatever we do. If we're doing it habitually, it creates its own sort of momentum, if you will, through the force of that habit, through the force of that familiarization. So the idea is that if we really cultivate our view of emptiness so that it becomes much more deeply ingrained, much more first nature, you know, much more prevalent in our understanding, and we realize things to be empty of inherent existence, then these other latencies of apprehending things as truly existent will be abandoned. So we do see that kind of, you know, our minds, this is one of the fundamental teachings that we've been dealing with, we deal with all the time in Buddhism, and discovering Buddhism, it goes back to the first module. You know, we've got a mind that has the ability to be however we want it to be. Do we want it to be full of these latencies of afflictions, all these kind of weeds that are in our garden that mess up everything? Or do we want to fill it with wisdom and compassion and all the other good things, the flowers in our garden? Through the force of cultivating and growing the one, especially when we're dealing with things that are diametrically opposed, such as the conception of true existence and the lack of true existence, the wisdom realizing that, these begin to offset each other. The view that understands emptiness begins to weaken and, you know, take dominance over the view that things exist inherently, the conception of true existence. So this is kind of what's being said here, is that this is what happens, is that we're able to, you know, begin to abandon our understanding of things as existing inherently. Second part of it, and through familiarizing with nothing whatsoever exists, that is the realization of lack of true existence, later on the apprehension of the lack of true existence as truly existent will also be abandoned. Okay, so we can realize that things, phenomena, lack true existence, but there's going to be a part of us perhaps that wants to think that emptiness truly exists, inherently exists. That through our understanding of the lack of inherent existence, this lack of inherent existence is something, I don't want to use the words dependable or reliable because it is, but that we want to like treat it and reify it and make it into something really bigger than all of this. If our realization of emptiness was quite complete, as we'll see, then we should have gotten rid of that in the process anyway, because we can't be adhering, again, to the ideas is that, as Arya Deva says, if we understand emptiness on the basis of one thing, we can understand it on the basis of another. Any phenomenon we turn the mind to, we understand its emptiness. So when we talk about this particular phenomenon, a mechanical pencil, I can realize the emptiness of mechanical pencil on this basis, but I can also realize the emptiness of mechanical pencil, because that emptiness is also empty. That emptiness has no true existence, no inherent existence. Although it is the final nature of phenomena, it lacks any ultimate reality. We can, you know, and again, we'll revisit this. In a sense, what we're going to start calling these is all these bases that we determine emptiness on are things. The emptinesses that we realize through that are what we call non-things. So things and non-things, and sometimes you'll see these phrases, the emptiness of things and the emptiness of non-things. Same emptiness. It's just the basis is different. The basis is things, phenomena other than emptiness, and then emptiness, which is a non-thing. It's not a thing. So, as it says here, when we kind of are familiarizing ourselves with that realization of lack of true existence, thinking nothing whatsoever exists, we'll even be able to overcome our apprehension of the lack of true existence, emptiness, as truly existent. However, you know, as we were saying earlier, if merely some sort of coarse object of refutation is refuted, if we haven't really touched on true emptiness, if we've not gone deep enough in terms of our realization, then true existence, you know, will need to be refuted later on. You're not going to be able to, you know, have that understanding if you don't touch the subtle object of refutation, as it was said earlier. So again, this whole thing, as I mentioned earlier, Lama Tsongkhapa spends a lot of his texts, in the Lam Rim texts that he wrote, talking about the two errors we make. One is negating too much. And this is the problem Barbara and I were talking during the break of negating existence along with true existence. So we think that if it doesn't exist truly, and this is what most of the lower schools have the problem with, they say then things can't function, things don't exist. If you say that that the person is not truly existent, then there's no person that can achieve enlightenment, that can achieve liberation, and so on. There's no basis. That's the one error. The other error is not negating enough. This is an error of not negating enough, talking about getting this core subject of refutation. We just haven't negated enough, so we're going to fall into some other extreme, kind of, not negating enough, keep holding things to still be existent at some level that they're not. So this refuted the existence that they did have. This refutes, or doesn't refute, the existence that they don't have. These two extremes that we fall into. Again, we've talked about these two extremes in our tenets class as well. This is why it's called the middle way, is because it manages to get us on that track between those two, so that we are identifying the correct object of negation, allows us to have things exist conventionally while saying they lack any ultimate existence. Okay. So, the last sentence of that paragraph, however, a refutation in which the subtle object of refutation, so what we really want people to get to, which is existence not merely posited by convention of name, taken as the measure of true existence. So where we've used that as the subtle object of refutation, when that has been refuted, that refutes the apprehension of true existence from that very time, and it will be immediately severed. So the idea is if you are actually touching on that true understanding of emptiness, then there will be some severance of your apprehension of true existence on the basis of that. And you'll be able to then, of course, realize the lack of inherent existence of emptiness as well on the basis of that. So this whole thing has been around, again, re-emphasizing that it's very effective. The main points that these other schools were raising is it's not necessary, nor is it effective. Highly effective if you got it right. Highly effective if you're actually hitting the nail on the head. And this is, again, why all those teachings from Lama Tsongkhapa to teach us that middle way. So when we went through our tenets class, actually, we did talk about the measure of true existence in Prasangika Madhyamika. And we gave something slightly different than this, just so you know. Again, you could call this, and this is what I went through earlier in class tonight, though, all these various synonyms. The measure of true existence is that which exists from its own side, that which exists by way of its own characteristics, that's which exists by its own power, that which exists inherently, that which exists in any way more than, which is what this is basically talking about, more than by mere convention, by mere naming, by mere designation. So in the end, we are negating up to that point. We want to cut it very, very tight, right to mere designation. Not go too far to where we get rid of that as well. And again, that's the extreme of annihilation, where we've bit off more than what we needed to. But we don't want to be too far away from it where we haven't negated enough, because then we don't have it yet. We're still shy of it. So this idea of this measure of true existence, this is an important concept. This goes back to our subtle object of refutation. How we define what it is that we're negating, so it's tight enough, not loose, but exactly where it needs to be. It's like Goldilocks or something, it's just right. This one's too soft, this one's too hard. This one's just right. Goldilocks was a Madhyamika book.
You never know what those stories.
Okay. Next verse, same as the first. verse 33. When it is said nothing exists, the thing that is investigated is not observed. At that time, how does a non-thing separated from the support, abide in front of the mind. Very grateful for commentary, huh? Verses like that. So when it is said that no thing exists truly, that's what that phrase means. I mean, that is in your verse. It just says no things, nothing exists. But when we kind of get to that point of realizing that nothing exists truly, there is nothing that has true existence, inherent existence. So if the thing that is investigated truly exists, then it would be suitable to be observed. So this is going back to, again, we're kind of like going on with our meditation on emptiness. First, Shantideva and Drukpa Gyaltsen were talking about the object of refutation. You identify the object of refutation so you know what you're looking for. Okay, so if things truly exist, you know, working, and we're going to work with this basis of nothing truly exists, but if we're really looking for this and have identified it correctly, then it's suitable to be observed. It's suitable to be found when we go looking for it. This is what all of our reasonings on emptiness are about, is you set out, basically, well, not all of them, maybe, but, yeah, because dependent arising isn't necessarily a reasoning that goes there. One of the main meditation techniques that we use entails looking for that inherently existent eye, that inherently existent cup, inherently existent candle, whatever it is that we're searching for. Do we find it? Do we find it either on the basis of imputation or apart from it? Where else would we look? If it's not here and it's not anywhere other than here, is there anywhere else to look? But this idea that it's suitable to be observed or suitable to be found is the basis for our analysis. If it really exists, then find it. Find something that is in an inherently existent pencil. And you might go, well, this is it. No, this isn't it. We'll get into that. I don't want to go there tonight. So this is where conventional wisdom is, you know, not to be followed. Because we all agree it inherently exists, but that doesn't mean that that's correct. Remember, we saw that earlier in one of the verses where Shantideva says, you know, we can't adhere to the conventions of the world in all matters because, you know, the world's not always correct. But, anyway. So it says, if that the thing that is investigated truly exists, then it is suitable to be observed. However, we find when we do these analyses, when we look for the inherently existent I and so on, it's not observed to truly exist. We cannot find the truly existent I. We cannot find inherently existent pencil. Hence, at that time of realizing that it does not exist truly, a truly existent non-thing is refuted. So, what is its non-thing? What did I say earlier? Was it the non-thing? The emptiness, okay. So let's use this idea of pencil. So it says, at that time of realizing that pencil, truly existent pencil, does not exist. So there is no truly existent pencil. A truly existent emptiness of pencil is also refuted. Why? Because its support, that is the property possessor, is separated from true existence. How can truly existent whatever abide in front of the mind? How can you have anything that has any true existence abide in front of the mind? It's a very, very tricky point. But the idea is that, again, if we use this idea of there's a basis for our realizing emptiness, which is a conventional phenomenon that we adhere to as truly existent, we go looking for true existence, truly existent whatever it is, we realize the lack of true existence on that support, on that basis. Then by the emptiness of that appearing, there's no way that we can have any adherence to that emptiness truly existing. There's a nice passage, I don't know that I want to read it necessarily, if you want to take a look at it, in this book, on page 167, that kind of goes into, let me just read the end part of it. It says, there cannot be the emptiness nature without its support. This is one of the things I was talking about to Barbara earlier as well, is that, you know, when we talk about kind of emptiness and phenomena, we talk about them, yeah, they are two distinct things, if you will. Thing isn't the right word. Two distinct objects. But they're totally interdependent. as we said earlier, and we said this in the tenets class as well, these are two things that are inextricably bound up in the same thing, the same phenomenon. So can you talk about emptiness of bell ringer without talking about bell ringer? Is there an emptiness of bell ringer without there being a bell ringer? You know, emptiness and... Well, it's a property. And that's why it's called here like the property possessor is the support for that emptiness. The emptiness doesn't exist apart from that support. So when Don ceases to exist, does emptiness of Don exist? No. The
but
two things...
Does that become a problem, though? I mean, this whole discussion is avoiding the attachment, the idea of emptiness.
Right. So what he's saying then is he's saying there cannot be the emptiness nature without its support. If the emptiness nature, you know, this property of emptiness, the absence of true existence, is a reality, meaning if it has some real true existence, inherent existence, it has to be truly existent somewhere in the nature of the support. Which I think is kind of a clearer explanation of it. It's kind of like, you know, if the dowel on this is brown, brown has to exist somewhere there, correctly? You know, we all say, we wouldn't call it brown if there was no brown there. You know, I don't say that this is brown. This is black. It has the property of black. So if emptiness of true existence is true, if it really exists, then I would find it, you know, out here on the basis, and I've already negated that there's any true existence in this basis. It's kind of, again, it's a finer point. I think it really is getting also to kind of the fact that what we said earlier, that if you're understanding lack of inherent existence on one basis, you absolutely understand it on all bases, whether it's emptiness or another object or whatever you're directing the mind towards. But the fact is that when you're working specifically with bell ringer and the emptiness of bell ringer, there's no way that you could say the emptiness of bell ringer has any inherent existence because you've already negated that there is any inherent existence established on this basis, on this support.
Yeah, but there could be a tendency, if you're not careful, to think that because emptiness exists on bell ringer and emptiness exists,
mm-hmm, yeah, and has its own thing. Yeah.
Remember that it is dependent on that.
Yeah.
That's really only an issue if you haven't actually realized
that. Yeah, I mean, I think we're talking in this commentary about. Yeah, I mean, we're going to find in our own sort of stumbling through our reasoning to get to emptiness that we will want to still adhere to inherent existence or to emptiness as being inherently existent, as having some true existence. But once we get to this point, it's going to be refuted. There's no adhering to it. Anyway, you might read this passage on 167 of this book, and it's kind of nice. Wisdom, two Buddhist commentaries. There's one copy in the library. I don't know who has it. Paul may have it. Paul Pulaski. He and Janice, I think, may have taken it out. But so the idea here is, then how could that, any measure of true existence, any idea of true existence abide in front of the mind? Once we've negated it on the basis, we've also then negated it in terms of the emptiness of that basis. If you're getting at 9 o'clock, I think we're just about baked. The mind is cooked. Let's do one more verse, though, if we could. Let's read 34. Yeah, this kind of completes this thought, which I think is a good place to stop. When neither thing nor non-thing abides in front of the mind, since there is no other aspect at that time, in the absence of objects of observation, elaborations are utterly pacified. So the commentary says here, you know, since there is no property that is separated from a property possessor, as we were just talking about, you know, emptiness of bell ringer is dependent upon bell ringer. You can't isolate it in terms of it being totally removed and independent of it. They're totally interdependent. If the emptiness of true existence is truly existent, then the property possessor must be established in the nature of the property. You know, it's kind of like, then there is a truly existent basis upon which, you know, truly existent emptiness exists, which sounds totally ridiculous because emptiness is a lack of inherent existence. Since its, the property possessor's, being established in the nature of true existence has been refuted earlier on. So earlier on, I think here means earlier on in the meditation on emptiness. So if I go into my meditation and want to realize the emptiness of this bell ringer, I've used this basis. I'm now realizing emptiness on that basis, so that there, I know there is no truly existent bell ringer. So that has already been refuted. So when neither a truly existent thing, because I've refuted it, so there's no truly existent thing, right? There's no truly existent bell ringer because it's already been established that it's empty, nor emptiness as truly existent. So where it says there a truly existent thing nor non-thing, what that means is neither of those being truly existent. You don't have a truly existent thing, you don't have a truly existent non-thing. So it's a little bit of a misnomer. You might want to put in parentheses there, nor truly existent non-thing abides in front of the mind. Because a non-thing does abide in front of the mind. When you realize emptiness, again, we take a conventional basis, which is, you know, whatever object we're working with, the self and so on, we work with this mistaken conception of it. On the basis of looking for that inherently existent object, we find that we can't locate it. It's not there. That's the realization of emptiness when we really deepen that and understand that there is no inherently existent bell ringer or self or whatever. What appears to the mind immediately after that is emptiness. The emptiness related specifically to that object we were working with, but it's the same emptiness that we would realize on the basis of any other object. That emptiness does appear to the mind, so a non-thing is appearing to the mind, but not a truly existent non-thing. So anyway, I was just kind of reiterating why that should read, neither a truly existent thing nor a truly existent non-thing abides in front of the mind, since there is no other truly existent aspect at that time. And all focal points that are the objects of observation of the effect, apprehension of true existence are absent. All aberrations are utterly pacified. Basically, it's saying there's nothing else going on. You're negating inherent existence, and you're realizing the lack of inherent existence. There's nothing, no other elaborations. The mind is free of elaborations. The mind is pacified at that time. So again, we're talking about a direct realization of emptiness. We're not talking about us all in the room, you know, as far as I can tell, my own experience, you know, thinking about emptiness. This is somebody who is actually realizing emptiness. So they're not seeing a truly existent thing, nor are they seeing a truly existent non-thing. They're seeing the mere emptiness of inherent existence on the basis of whatever object they were contemplating. For, in the perspective of a person who directly realizes emptiness, even dualistic elaborations regarding emptiness are pacified. So there's no ignorance, nothing manifest in the mind that is elaborating that how things exist. As I said, even the dualistic apprehension of subject and object, when we directly realize emptiness, is gone. Emptiness and the mind realizing it are like water poured into water. There's no differentiation of subject and object. So this is, again, regarding this direct realization. It says, but for a realization by way of a meaning generality, conceptual realization, inferential realization. When we have that inferential realization of emptiness, then it's slightly different. As it says there, even though dualistic appearances have not been stopped, in its perspective, the elaborations of true existence have been stopped. So even though you haven't gotten rid of all this dualistic, you know, appearances, if you are really hitting the nail on the head and realizing emptiness conceptually, inferentially, a valid cognition of emptiness inferentially, you are not going to have manifest elaborations. You're not going to have a manifest ignorance that's misapprehending things to inherently exist. Why? Because you have the conception in your mind that things don't inherently exist. Okay? So let's go back to the dream analogy. So again, we often use this idea of things being like, dreamlike. If we become aware in our dreams that things don't exist as real, that they're just dream objects, which we can have, you know, some form of lucid dreaming where we're aware that we are dreaming. Oh, there comes my dream mother, you know, there's my dream father, and so on. All these various dream appearances. It doesn't stop the dualistic appearances. This is just our conceptual mind having the understanding that those dream objects aren't real. So I can't have a conception that they're dream objects or that they're real objects when I have a conception that they're dream objects. They're totally opposed to each other. Seeing the dream object as real and seeing the dream object as unreal are contradictory. So I can still have some conceptual understanding of emptiness that keeps my mind from apprehending things as truly existent, even though it, you know, isn't as effective, certainly, as a non-conceptual mind. Okay, I don't know. Again, this is all just elaborations on this one verse to kind of give us some idea of what's all meant by this. Then it goes on to say, this stanza and the following five stanzas, so in total, you know, six stanzas from verse 34 through 39, extensively reveal the mode of abidance of the effect. In other words, how things actually exist with, given this realization of emptiness, given our understanding of things lacking inherent existence, how they can still function and so on. So we're going to see that in the verses to come specifically, is kind of explaining how things still have some conventional existence in spite of the way that they lack inherent existence. So recall, I mean, this goes back to your commentary on page, and we'll stop. Even though we haven't completed this paragraph, I think it's okay to stop there, and we'll come back to that. If you go back to page 229, recall that right in the middle of the page there, just a little bit below, it says that there are three modes of apprehension of the mind. Apprehension of the I as truly established, really established, that's the misconception. Second, apprehension of an I lacking true existence, which is what we're talking about here. With this understanding of emptiness, if you cultivate it in your mind, even conceptually, you can generate some conception of the mind lacking inherent existence. This also, though, it doesn't. The third one, then, is the apprehension of a mere I without making a distinction through one of those two modes of apprehending it. So the second one is also something that we gain through more than just conceptual realization. If we get a direct realization of emptiness, obviously we stop apprehending the I as having true existence through the force of that wisdom. But it said even in regard to getting it conceptually, at that time when we are not adhering to true existence, it's that apprehension. We're apprehending an I as lacking true existence or any phenomenon. You could replace that I with any phenomenon. Anyway, sorry, maybe that was too much to kind of throw on the end there. But so any questions? Again, I'll save that last little bit of this other verse. It's kind of a strange paragraph anyway. I'm not really... I won't have much to say about it. There's a few of those coming up where basically I'm going to, you know, maybe skip over things or very briefly touch on, like, His Holiness's commentary on them, and that's it, because I think we're in danger of going into these maybe and not really understanding them correctly, and I don't want that to occur either. So any questions to conclude? How is this going? I mean, we've been doing this now for several weeks with the commentary, and this is different than how we've been approaching Shantideva before, because we've generally just worked with the root text, but is it okay for everyone? Are we okay? Again, I have to admit for myself it's a little more challenging just because I have to explain the commentary, which explains the root verse, and not just the root verse. And the commentary helps in places, but there are places where I frankly find it a little challenging. So anyway, I may adjust myself to that, as I said, kind of leaving some pieces out here and there. But let's do our dedication prayers, maybe page 235 of the prayer book. We'll just do these first two prayers on this page in English. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. Let's go to page 246. And we'll recite these verses from the final chapter of Shantideva's text. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. You can turn back on 244, recite these long life prayers. Actually, we didn't pass out the other prayer. That's okay. It's okay. So we'll just recite the long life prayer for His Holiness in English and then for Rinpoche in English as well. I think that we're creating the causes for the success of the spontaneous fulfillment of all the wishes of His Holiness the Dalai Lama as well as Lama Zopa Rinpoche, and also creating the causes for the good health and long lives of all teachers with whom we have a special karmic connection, so that we might never be separated from them or the precious Dharma that they teach in this lifetime and all lifetimes until we attain enlightenment. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjunath's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. And lastly, we can send out peace so that there's peace in the hearts and minds of all beings throughout all realms. Just kind of sending it out like a pebble creating ripples on every part of the surface of the water. Okay, thank you all very much.